All right, as we look through the first several chapters of 1 Samuel, we realize that what this author has done has sort of placed the last part of the Judges with the first part of 1 Samuel. So as we look at 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 7, we're looking at a discussion of the judge Samuel and things that went on there, the death of Eli and so on, where the Ark of the Covenant is taken. And then finally in chapter 8, we start getting up into the discussion of Saul. Now, I think we should note, of course, when it comes to Samuel, we see that he was how did he start off his life, as it were? Little baby Samuel. How? Terry? Right. Okay. So his mom and dad, Elkanah, right, his dad, and his mom is Hannah, right? So Elkanah and Hannah, they dedicated Samuel to God and then left him with who? Where? Yeah, left him with Eli at the tabernacle, which I believe was in Shiloh. Yeah, I think I mistakenly said Shechem a few weeks ago. And so Shiloh was where the tabernacle was raised up, and it was sort of the spiritual capital of Israel to a certain extent. But I mean, it was the place where Israel was supposed to be centered. I think we find that wasn't the case in many instances. Anyway, it seems like that Samuel was a pretty nice guy. But when we get to the beginning of chapter 8, better silence my phone before somebody calls me here. We get to the beginning of chapter 8, though, and we look at verses 1 through 3. It says, "It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted justice." So who does that remind you of in Samuel's sort of, you might say, direct lineage of his adopted family here? Adoptive family. Eli and his sons, right? So it seems like that his sons were going down the family path, as you might say, which is unfortunate. But anyway, that sort of takes care of the judges there up to chapter 8. And then as we get into chapter 8, we can see that we start the story of Saul, who, as we know, will be the first king. And so we got to chapter 13 last time. All of the stuff from 8 about up to 13 is just more or less the appointment of Saul, the various stories around his appointment. And actually, when we get right down and look at it, how many times was Saul appointed king? Three times, right? So there was the first time that Samuel sort of did it kind of privately. And then there was another time what was more public, but then there was the last time was when they sort of got everybody together and made this a public thing. It's interesting to note in chapter 13 of the American Standard Version, it'd be interesting to see what we have in the other various versions that we might have, and we have a supplied word here, but in chapter 13, verse 1, the American Standard Version says, "Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel," etc. Now, the word 40 in the American Standard Version is supplied. I think probably because the editors thought that was reasonable. I think there's some significantly different text than some of the others. What have you got, Lynn?
It's the New King James. Verse 1 says, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel.
Yeah. And that's I think, Chris, you have the New American, is that right?
Yeah, it reads as yours.
Oh, it does. It says 40? Oh, okay. Anybody else got anything besides New King James and New American? I can look in many of the perverted versions here on PC Study Bible. Let me see what something like the what?
Heathen versions.
What? The King James? Oh, yeah. David, you got King James, don't you? What does it say? Chapter 13, verse 1. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. What do you got, Terry?
The English Standard Version.
Okay.
Reads Saul lived for 1 year and then became king.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Now I'm looking at, mine says English Standard Version, but it's different. It says Saul was blank, blank years old when he began. And he reigned blank and 2 years over eight. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. I want to see what the New International has to say. Great. Saul was 30 years old when he became king and reigned over Israel 42 years. All right. So we appear to have a certain amount of disagreement in the translations. Here we go. This is called the International Standard Version, which is different than the New International Version. It's one that's come out in just the last few years. Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he ruled for 42 years over Israel. So if we get down into some of the really weird ones, like, let me see, there was the, where is it? The Message? There it is. No telling Saul. Saul was a young man when he began as king, and he reigned over Israel for many years. There you go. That's very, that's sufficiently, broad, yeah. I was gonna knew there was another one here. Oh, the Revised Standard is supposed to be one that, they do it there too. They put the blanks in there. We already looked at that, but there was one that was the Amplified, that was it. That's where he's got all sorts of commentary. But he goes, Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, etc. Okay. So, let's go back to the American Standard. And that's interesting. It's got two closing parentheses. Anyway, it says, Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereof 2,000 were with Saul and Michmash in the Mount of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan and Gibeah of Benjamin, and the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. Now, here's where the sort of confusion comes in. Who's Jonathan? His son. Therefore, his son has to be at least, what, 20 years old to be a fighting age, right? And so That I think is why people have supplied this number for when Saul was chosen as king. But there is no indication in the Bible how old he was. What do we know of his rank in his family? I don't know whether he was the. He had brothers, right? Now I think I'm getting confused with David because I just read about David this morning, but. Saul had a few brothers, but I don't think that he was the... Oh, yeah, that's right. His brothers were seeking him when he went out to find the donkeys and things like that and all. So he had a number of brothers, but it's not as detailed as when we look at David. I think it's the story of David that I'm looking at. David was the youngest in the family. So there's actually no implication at all in the biblical text as to exactly how old Saul was. We do know that he was, what? He was head and shoulders taller than everybody else. He was fairer to look at and all that sort of stuff, and he was a great fighting man. I think also when I looked up Jonathan, it indicates that he was a man of great stature as far as, let's see. No, once again, I'm thinking of David. I'm going to have to quit doing that. Later on, when we see that David is chosen as the youngest son of Jesse to become king, we see that in the discussion about Goliath, that it mentions that Saul, that David was a man that was familiar with combat. So that's interesting to know. Let's stick on Saul here if I can. And anyway, we see that what did Samuel say to the people when they asked for a king? He said, of many other things. Obviously, I'm fishing for something here, but right here in the second verse, look at here. Saul's picking out people, 3,000 people, and they're going to be his standing army. And so he's going to send, he sent 2,000 to Michmash and Bethel, and then 1,000 went with Jonathan in Gibeah. Let me go over to the map that I've got here. It's actually in your book on page, if I get down to it here, is it 85? Let me see. 86. I noticed that this map, for example, is in the book with the multicolored cover, and then this book this map is in the book without the with the yellow cover, and I'm not sure which one I like better, but this one's got a cool border on it and all that sort of stuff, and the color's a little brighter. But if we look at this and expand this, what am I at? 102. I'm going to 150% here, and note that as we look up here at the top, that's the bottom of what body of water? Sea of Galilee. And then we've got, obviously, the Dead Sea down here. It gives it away a clue because it says dead right there. Anyway, so all of this stuff is happening around here. So we see that 2,000 went to Saul in Michmash and Bethel. So here's Bethel right here, and here's Michmash. So they're fairly close together. And then the other 1,000 went with Jonathan where? Gibeah. And so the other ones went with Jonathan in Gibeah. And notice for some reason he's got this underlined and got a star by it. I guess he considers that to be an important city. But so what we've got here is we've got 1,000 troops stationed here. We've got 2,000 troops stationed here. Let me pull up, I have Google Earth up here, and just to remind us of where we are and where we're going and all that sort of stuff. And if we go to, remember that as we zoom in on the United States, you know, here we are right here. You can wave at the camera. Yeah, so there we are. And if we pull out again into space and go around the world, we see that we've gone about halfway around the world, and we end up in these areas right here. Now, of course, if we zoom into the area that we're looking at right now, we can get a little bit more detail of the terrain that's in this area. Let me turn this sidebar off. And we can see that the areas that we're talking about are essentially straight across from the top of the Dead Sea. So Jerusalem, et cetera, is over here, sort of on the spine of these mountains. And so you can see this is all sort of a mountainous area. If I take and make... Oh, I was kind of hoping that that would work a little better than that. But all right. I had these set up, and I assumed that they were going to go to the same place, but since I've changed my screen resolution, I guess that's not the case. So if we look at these side by side... Hello. Computers hate me. All right. So if we look at these side by side, and I'll make their scales, approximately equal. Come over here and look at this. We've got all right, so that's about the same. You can see the little hook of the Dead Sea down here at the bottom, and that's what this is right here on the actual map. So as we move over a little bit here to where we can see into the west side of Israel and sort of make the thing similar, let me go to 100%. All right. So now we see that we've got the Sea of Galilee up here and the Sea of Galilee there. Go away. The Dead Sea down here, and here's that little hook, you know, thumbs up thing right here. And then the bottom of the Dead Sea, of course, is used as a salt basin, harvest. They harvest salt down there. Anyway, so as we go directly over from the, essentially from the top of the Dead Sea, and just down a little bit, we get to Jerusalem and Bethlehem. So as we go over a little bit and just down, so we got Jerusalem and Bethlehem right here. And then up above it, still in the mountains though, we've got Bethel and Michmash and Gibeah down in this area right here. So it's all in sort of at least at the best, a hilly area. If we were to zoom in on this, we would see that there's actually quite a bit of mountainous type area in there. A lot of passes and places between mountains and things like that where people can get through, but it's still something you got to pick your way through in order to get around it. All right. So as we once again look at where we are in the Bible, we see that Saul is sort of, to a certain extent, fulfilling a bit of the prophecy of Samuel, and the prophecy, I guess we could say, of Moses way back in the olden days, that said that the king would take your men and use them. We see here now that Jonathan, the son of Saul, he went out and smote the garrison of the Philistines. Now, if we look on the map that you have once again on page 86, is this it? No. This one? Nope. This one, yes. That you have on page 86. We can see here that by this time we see that Philistia, where the Philistines live or have taken, is actually a pretty big area. It makes quite a bit of an trying to think of the word.
Intrusion
into the land of Israel. Same thing with the Canaanites here. They're pretty solidly ensconced in this area over on the coast, all the way up to Mount Carmel, and all the way down here to the, Ajalon River, and all the way in to Jerusalem, actually, because who took Jerusalem finally? No, from the Jebusites. David did, right. So we're still a king away from getting Jerusalem actually in the picture here. So right now we've got all this stuff. We've got Gibeon and Mizpah and all that sort of stuff. All of these things are places where Israel is working around these days. And I think, isn't Shiloh up here next to Shechem somewhere? It's like up here, I think. But I'd have to look that up. Anyway, we have a tendency to think of Jerusalem as always having been the center of Israel, but it wasn't, not until David came on board. And it wasn't until a few years after he became king that he actually attacked and took Jerusalem, which became known then later on as the city of David. But we realize also that Bethlehem is the city of David because David was born there, right? Bruce, did you have something? Yeah, there is. It appears to be quite greenish in the area. You know, if you look over here on the east side of the Jordan, once you get up on the plateau, we notice that it's telling me that this is above 3,000 feet up here. And if we look at these mountains down here, they're still in the 2,300 foot range. If we look at this area right here, we see that there's what appears to be a lot of vegetation there. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, this actually looks like trees here, which is interesting because there are no trees to speak of in Israel. Yeah, a lot of vegetation though. So, and you can definitely see where the desert is. Okay, all of the little dot things you see around here, just little villages and stuff. You can see a little clearer on my computer, but you can see that the desert obviously extends into this area. So up on the east side of the mountains, you know, once again, Jerusalem is right about here somewhere, and then down the mountains into the Jordan River Valley, it's all just desert. And the same thing on the other side until you get up here, up into the plateau above there. And then we have some more mountains, and up further up to the north, we got more vegetation and things like that. So, but down here, it's just all desert. And of course, you head on toward the Sinai Peninsula and all that sort of stuff. Off to Egypt, it's all desert until you get to the Nile River. So technically, I guess it's all part of the Sahara Desert, or at least the lower part of Israel. all right. Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting. If you drive across the Sinai, the top of the Sinai Peninsula, right up here, in this area, there's a road that goes fairly close to the Mediterranean right here, and it's just sand all the way up. It's just sand dune. It's like it's a big beach all the way down to here, you know, which is quite a ways. You know, here we have a scale of miles. That's really nice, 73 miles. So this is at least 50 miles inland, and you're still just working on the beach right there. Kind of like being outside here. You got plenty of beach, no water. And, of course, the thing is that we would normally think that, well, there's water here. Things ought to grow. But what kind of water is it? It's salt water, right? So unless you have some freshwater intrusion, which is what we have here with the Nile River, which at the early days, I think, split off into like seven different branches, but now there's only two or three left. The others have kind of silted up, but they still provide enough irrigation that they're able to keep the Nile Delta going. and even here in the oasis of Fayyum, we see that there's just a little bit of water there, but it's actually staying that way because it sort of seeps in from the Nile River, which is kind of interesting. There used to be, you can see, there used to be a channel that went from the Nile River over to there, but it silted up a long, long time ago. Anyway, yeah. So, and this area here, if we zoom in on this, this is actually water right here. So this is just sort of a spit of land right here that sort of closes off this area and then this water intrusion into there. Sir? Yes, right. If we were to zoom in on here somewhere, we would probably see where certain rivers empty into the sea. Then that looks like one right there. Though I imagine that if I were the people that lived in Egypt, I'd make sure that no water reaches the sea. You know, we need that water for irrigation type thing. So it may be much like the Rio Grande. By the time you get down to El Paso, the water's gone, essentially. So that's why the state of Texas is suing the state of New Mexico to let more water down. So, yeah. So anyway, so let's get off of Egypt. Go back here to Israel. So we're in this area approximately, right around here. And so we see that there's a lot of topography in this area. That, and the thing is that what that means is that there's a lot of defensible land, because you've got forests and you've got hills and you've got cliffs and things like that. And then you'll remember that there was the discussion and that's coming up in just a little bit here regarding this. That what did I do? Something horrid. It's on another map that I have here. Yeah, this map right here talks about the battle that we're going to get ready to look at. And so if I increase the size of this map. All right. You'll remember that we said that there were garrisons at Michmash and Gibeah and Bethel. So there's a battle that we're going to see takes place here, and what it does is that we have an inset down here that shows, it talks about these two cliffs that are there with a pass right between it. A mountain pass goes through there. There's a cliff on one side on the Geba side, and there's another cliff on the Michmash side. And this is where sort of the battle took place, and where Jonathan's rout of the army began. If we go back to the text, and so let me pull the map up again real quick. Not that map, this map. If we pull the map up again real quick and look at, because the text is going to go to Geba, we see that it's just a little bit south of Michmash. It's between Michmash and Gibeah. It doesn't show up on the larger scale map. So between here is where that mountain pass is. So if we go back here to the text, we see that Jonathan went out and he smote the garrison, it says, of the Philistines. It was in Geba. So it's in that hilly area. The Philistines had come up there sort of to make a raid, and Jonathan did that. The Philistines heard about it, and they didn't much care for that. So, but when he realized that it says the Philistines blew the trumpet, in other words, they're calling their forces together. Notice that here it says that all Israel heard that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. So, after all, Saul is what? The king. So, all authority goes to him. So, anyway. So now he's had an abomination with the Philistines, hard to believe. So the Philistines got a bunch of people together. They encamped, it says, in Michmash, which is eastward of Beth-Aven. So if once again we look at this map here, we see that they camped in Michmash. It says that was east of Beth-Aven, so Beth-Aven's over in here somewhere. And so the Philistines are encamped there. I don't think it shows any better down here. So they're there. And then it says that they had a bunch of people. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand on the seashore. So a goodly number of people, we might say. And so the men of Israel, it says, they were in a strait. Now they were distressed. One could see why they felt that way, because Saul had only how many people together so far? Just the 3,000, right? So, yeah. Yeah, Saul had 3,000 people, and only 2,000 of them were up there in the Michmash area, and another 1,000 of them. It's all the way over on the left side, Wendy. And so there were only 2,000 or 3,000 people available to him at that time, and it's not like it was easy traveling anyway. So they're a bit outnumbered just by the chariots. You know, where is it? 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and a whole bunch of other people. So we can see why that they were a bit distressed. And some of them decided that they were just going to go across the river. And so if we look at that on the map that's on the it's in the book on page 86, we see that the battle's about to take place here, and some of them decided that the better place for them to be would be over here. So they went over here to the land of Gad and such alike as that. All right, so there's obviously a big battle about to take place. Saul is with his army, and he's waiting in Gilgal, which seems a little strange to me, but because Gilgal, remember, is the city that they founded shortly after they originally crossed the Jordan River and conquered Jericho, which was up here about where the S is in Michmash. So we see here that though his army is here at Bethel and Michmash and Gibeah, Saul is down here in Gilgal. So he's a fur piece away. He's a little safer down there because that's a bit difficult for the army to get from the mountains down here into the Jordan River Valley. Plus, it leaves them open to attack because there's no place for them to hide. So the people that were here and ready to go already would have an advantage over people that were coming down from the hills. So we see that Saul, he's waiting in Gilgal. And it says the people were being scattered from him. Now, what is he waiting for? He's waiting for Samuel. Now, I'm unclear on whether the 7 days that he waits here in verse 8 are the same 7 days that we're talking about in chapter 10, because there seems to be a lot of stuff going on in the intervening time. But they seem to be connected. Samuel apparently had appointed a time that he says, I'll come down to you and we'll discuss things after 7 days. And so Saul is waiting down there and the people are scattering from him. And so what does Saul do? He made the offering. Now, who's permitted to do offerings? The priests, right? Yes.
Not just any priest. Wouldn't it have to be the lineage of Aaron, or is that one of the high priests?
The high priest is of the lineage of Aaron.
So any other priest?
And all the rest of the priests are of the lineage of Moses, generally. So Moses and Aaron being brothers, right? So Levi. The Moses and Aaron were both sons of Levi, yes. So the division was from Aaron and then the other people that were not related to Aaron. So only the high priest could only come out of the lineage of Aaron.
Because Samuel came down through Korah and Kohath, I thought. And so he wouldn't have really been able to offer sacrifice, would
he? He was the prophet at the tabernacle. Was he not? I didn't even look at this. Was he not a Levite?
I think so. Everything that I was researching puts him way over there by under Kohath. Down Korah, yeah. His part, and then Korah. And then a couple of Elkanahs and then.
But isn't Korah part of the tribe of Levi?
Yeah.
Okay.
Over the Kohath. I thought
I see. Okay. All right. So they had different things that they were supposed to. These people were supposed to carry the table. These people were supposed to carry the tabernacle, and they were all lined up there. And I've never really bothered to look at that to see how they line up. But it seems to me that at least by the time that we see the peripheral discussion about it in the New Testament, that it's simply Levites. In other words, people. That's all the distinction they make, other than the high priest, is that by the implication anyway that I get from the New Testament is that all we're looking at is you're either a Levite, and if you're a Levite, and if you're of the lineage of Aaron, then you can be a high priest. If you're not of the lineage of Aaron, then you're just simply a Levite. So if we look at the parable of the guy that got beat up on the way to Jericho. The Good Samaritan, yes. I knew there was a title that we had given to it. If we look at that, we see that it mentions that a priest went down by him. It said a Levite went by him. And then it said a Samaritan went by him. Went by. Now, I'm unclear as to what the differentiation between a priest and a Levite is in that particular instance. I would get the idea that a priest would be the one who could make sacrifices and things, and a Levite would be the one who handled the other stuff, whatever there was to do. We see that when John the Baptist's dad, what's his name? David?
The question is, that was still called a Levitical priesthood, was it not?
Yeah. Yes, as was Moses.
Yeah. It seems to say either priest or just Levite. I guess, of course, that's about all I know about that.
Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of people that descended from Levi. And so if we go back into the book of Exodus and we see the division of the labors regarding the tabernacle, we can see that there are quite a number of different fathers' lineages that are supposed to take care of various other responsibilities that have to do with the tabernacle, other than offering sacrifices. Yeah, and yeah, those kind of things. Who was John the Baptist's parents? Elizabeth and Zacharias, right? And so what was Zacharias doing? He was in the temple serving. He was, lighting the incense or something like that in the temple when the angel appeared to him to tell him that his son was going to be born. And so we can see that when we look at the discussion of Zacharias and Elizabeth in the New Testament, we see that they were both of the tribe of Levi, and that he had a job to do that was in the temple. But of course, we don't see that the job that he had to do, at least the one that we're talking about, had anything to do with sacrifices. It had to do with lighting the incense and whatever they were supposed to do regarding that. But it didn't mention anything about him making sacrifices. So that would probably make a really interesting story to line up all of these families and see who was supposed to do what, and then how it ended up years later as to whether or not they continued that. I guess when we came to the temple, a lot of those duties were no longer needed. I mean, we didn't need to cover the Ark of the Covenant anymore and move it and such a like as that. Yeah, Jenny?
Just as a side note, 1 Samuel 1:1 says that Samuel's dad is an Ephraimite.
Ephraimite? The heathen? No, he doesn't.
Well, he lived there. I did a little bit of research on that, too. And it says he lived there, but he wasn't necessarily. It's like Zeus is sometimes a person, sometimes a region.
Oh, yeah.
So it said he wasn't necessarily of the tribe.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
I suppose. No, but though, I would think that if a person were a Levite, he'd call him a Levite. But yeah, you're right. Okay. All right. Well, all right. So this certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham.
And several of those names in that list are called differently in different lists. They're spelled differently.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mickey's going to be wondering what I've been doing. What do you mean you only got three verses?
I was just wondering that, maybe in those days, if they didn't have, that Samuel could have gotten away with it, it would have been.
And maybe that's what it was. It was more of a gotten away with it thing than anything. Or, you know, the person that happened to be at the door of the tent of meeting at the time or whatever. But we see indeed that Eli served at the tabernacle, as did Samuel and Eli's sons, and perhaps even Samuel's sons. I don't know that it says that there. It just says that they were base fellows. I would think that they hadn't lost it so badly that they didn't know that they were supposed to be Levites that were supposed to be attending at the tabernacle. I don't know. A good study that we'll have to go through. It could take several months probably. Okay, where was I? Saul was offering, and Saul wasn't supposed to do that. Now if we once again go up here to the first verse of chapter 13, and if we can get some discussion, I need to say 30 or 10:30, but my pager's way off. if we can get some consensus here about verse 1 of chapter 13, where at the end of the American Standard Version, when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, seems more reasonable than saying that like some of the other versions say, that his total reign over Israel was 42 years. That doesn't seem necessarily to fit in here, though it does go along with a lot of the other discussions. In other words, so and so was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 197 years, and so on, and then he was superseded by so and so. But we see here that it says that he was however many years old when he began to reign. When he'd reigned over two years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men. That seems reasonable. There seemed to be a lot of discussion going on between all the people as to just exactly who was king here anyway. After they finally got it decided, and everybody said, long live the king, then Saul starts doing things here. But, of course, the Philistines were over there sort of toward the seaside to a certain extent, and they would make raids and incursions into Israel, and perhaps that's what he was preparing for here to put those garrisons in that area. Anyway, Saul wanted to follow God, and he seemed very zealous to do so at the beginning. But he has a tendency to rationalize things when they're not working out the way that he wants them to. So all the people are leaving him while he's at Gilgal, and he says, well, Samuel's not here to offer the offering, so tell you what, I'm king, I'll do it. So he does it, and lo and behold, he's offering the sacrifice, and up walks Samuel, sort of like a, what you doing? And what is this the beginning of, as it were? It's the beginning of the end. The guy's only been in power for about 2 years, and the first thing he does is offer a sacrifice that he's not supposed to be touching. Yeah, Terry.
Yeah, but at the beginning of the
Yes.
Forever. But now it's going to be removed from you, and I'm going to appoint someone after my own heart.
Right. Yeah, and that's an interesting thing that he uses that phrase there. He says that I'm looking for a person after my own heart. And then later on he says that about, yes. Chris?
Well, to me one of the interesting things is that, again, God wanted to be the king. And the only reason they asked for a king was they wanted to be like the other nations.
Right.
They were looking at things physically.
Yes, the other nations.
And it's almost like God was saying, if you want to be physically like the other nations, I'll give you a king physically like what you're looking for. The fact is Saul looked the part. Saul looked like a king.
Oh, yeah, sure. He was... Yeah. Yes, that's right. He did not. Okay, the heart of the king. Yeah, yeah. One that, once again, I think Mickey mentioned this a couple of times last time, is that Saul had great intentions, but he just didn't have, he didn't have the conviction, you might say, to carry them out properly. All right, Wednesday, we'll start in chapter 13 of all places.